podcast is brought to you by
Head on down to your local Jackrabbit Slims for a rocking good time, because at Jackrabbit Slims, every night is a blast from the past. Catch a show performed by one of our toe tapping singing servers, then twist the night away on our retro 50s style dance floor. Enjoy an old-fashioned $5 shake while you relax in one of our classic American-made automobile booths, and let Jackrabbit Slims take you back to the good old days. The movie stars are out tonight, folks, so head on down to Jackrabbit Slims off Route 66 for great food, killer tunes, and magical memories. Don't be a square, daddy-o. Come get your share of the fun at Jackrabbit Slims, the hippest joint in town.
I heard you did a pilot.
That was my 15 minutes.
What was it?
It was a show about a team of female secret agents called Fox Force 5.
What?
Fox Force 5. Fox as in we're a bunch of foxy chicks. Force as in we're a force to be reckoned with. And five as in there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us. There was a blonde one, Somerset O'Neill. She was a leader. The Japanese fox was a kung fu master. The black girl was a demolition expert. French Fox's speciality was sex.
What was your special?
Knives.
The character I played, Raven McCoy, her background was she grew up raised by circus performers. According to the show, she was the deadliest woman in the world with a knife. And she knew a zillion old jokes. Her grandfather, an old vaudevillian, taught her. And if we would have got picked up, it would have worked in a gimmick where every show I would have told another joke.
You know any animal jokes?
Well, I only got the chance to say one because we only did one show.
Tell me.
It's corny.
Don't be that way. Tell me.
Nah, you wouldn't like it and I'd be embarrassed.
You told like 50 million people and you can't tell me? I promise I won't laugh.
That's what I'm afraid of, Vince.
Welcome all you inglorious bastards to another episode of Character Study, the monthly series dedicated to exploring the psychological makeup, motivations, and complexities of the characters that reside in the world of Pulp Fiction. I'm your host, the Reverend Scott K, and on this month's episode, we'll be focusing our examination on the nose-powdering, twist contest-winning gangster's wife, Mia Wallace, to see what makes her tick. Joining me on this exploration is the producer of the J-Days YouTube channel, writer for the In Session Film website, film critic, poet, visionary artist, and wild woman at heart, Miss Jalen Sala Salman. Welcome, Miss Salman, and may Tarantino be with you always.
May Tarantino be with us always. Thank you, Scott.
You're very welcome. Thank you for joining me this season as I have tried to expand the members of the church and really was hoping to get more of a female community. As we were talking before we started recording, it is kind of boring when you just get the same side of the story from the same perspective. It is a much better discussion and a view of the world when you get multiple points of view. That way you can kind of get an idea of what everyone's feelings and thoughts are, especially when we're talking about Tarantino, especially when we're going to talk about Mia Wallace. So it is good to have the female perspective and not just a bunch of men going, well, I know what women think and what women wanted from this film. So thank you for being brave and coming on. You know, it is strange. With him being such a female-centered writer, why do you think not a lot of women don't come out as a big fan of his as much as men do?
Okay, I'm going to tell you my idea. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I love Quentin Tarantino so much. And I think, in my opinion, every hardcore cinephile loves Tarantino. Okay, even all the people who claim to not love him, because he has had this effect on us. At some point, he broke boundaries. He had such an effect on popular culture. And he's out there all the time. He's been there since a lot of time. Like us millennials were kind of raised with him. So, yeah, I mean, how can you ignore him? This, first of all. Second of all, sometimes I feel like some females are afraid that if they express their love for something, even while criticizing it, they would be deemed less feministy. You know what I mean? Like, you're not a good feminist. There's always this accusation. You're not a good feminist. So I kind of like adopt the Roxane Gray. I'm going to check the name. But I'm a bad feminist, okay? I'm trying to work on myself, you guys. I'm trying always to make myself a better woman. So why can't I like Tarantino? First of all, I don't know, like, I don't really get offended by the way he portrays women, even if it's kind of sexualized in a way. I don't feel like it's very overt. Like, sometimes I've seen, probably because I see a lot of movies, and a lot of the Italian and the French movies, they kind of over-sexualize in a way that makes me so uncomfortable in ways that is, no, this is not cinema, you guys. This is like straight out porn. But at the same time, there's sexualization that I love for men and women. Like, I love it. This is cinema. We have to be like out there, you know, like bodies and sex and all this gore and all these amazingness. Besides, there's always the sense of a tongue in cheek, you know what I mean? Like, you have Salma Hayek putting her foot in his mouth. So it's like, I don't know, it's such a domination. I don't see it as something offensive. It's actually like he's being empowered by this woman, you know, like, I mean, and her foot is kind of like phallic. So I don't know, every single thing he does, his violence, his gore, his sexual women are not that objectified as much as it's sexualized for viewers. We are all perverts just watching this movie. So yeah, this I think is kind of
all exactly. Perverts just like him. That's a good I might like, be a new tagline for the church. Come to the church, be a pervert just like him.
And you know the scary thing about him, he's looking us in the eye and he's like challenging us, like, haha, I know you. You women, you love my movies. Stop complaining. So this is what I love about him. Like, I love people with an edge. So yeah, I think a lot of women are afraid of expressing their love for this master of cinema and writing scripts because they're afraid they will be deemed less, you know, like supportive or less feminist. And because I think, like, okay, I'm gonna go a little bit off topic, but stop. When you just try to talk about, you know, like a sexual male in a movie and something like that, you find men doing it for women and sometimes men doing it for men. But when women, they try to be more conservative in their writing. I don't like that, buddy. Come on. Express that you like that they show the guy topless. Do it. Just be open about it. Hello. Or they would say it about women and go on and on and on because I don't want to show myself. And, you know, like I'm eyeing this guy. No, we are doing it. Tarantino, for me, encapsulates this feeling, you know what I mean? You guys are looking at her foot and I'm gonna put it in your face. So I love this.
It's a great perspective. And it is interesting. You know, I think sometimes people are afraid to go against what, you know, what they consider the mainstream or to fight upstream, which is odd because he is, I would say, a very pro female writer. Almost all his female characters, and even Daisy Domergue, they're still empowered. Like, she was the mastermind of what's going on in The Hateful Eight. Mia Wallace is the center of this story. She is the honey trap. She is, I mean, we are warned about her within the first 5 minutes of the film, and when they've never seen her, we don't, you know, and when we're introduced to her, which we'll get into, we see her feet first. Like, there's a lot of stuff that empowers us about Mia Wallace. She is the one character, as we're going to discuss, who is so hard to wrap our heads around and understand who she is, what she's about, where'd she come from, how does she find herself in this position. And then he goes on to write, I mean, obviously Uma and him work together, we've got Kill Bill, a movie full of strong female characters. Then we get Death Proof, a movie full of strong female characters. I almost forgot Jackie Brown, the first real empowered woman. Wow. Pam Grier holds the screen. Like, there are so many strong women characters in his films. You know, it's weird that, as you said, that there are women who feel ashamed or like it's not right to say, I like Tarantino, and express why, because I, like we talked before, he was raised by women. His father really didn't have much to do with him. He's raised by his mom. And then there, as he's described many times, he also had two other women living with him, an Hispanic and a black woman who were both nurses with his mom. So the three of them lived there, basically raised him. So he's a multicultural upbringing. He's brought up by women. And so you can see it in the fact that he writes strong black characters and strong female characters. And a lot of the times the villains are white people. So for so many people to give him shit, like, he really has been kind of an ally in many ways.
Very
to
much.
Females and the black community in a way that no other real writer in Hollywood has really been doing, especially a white male writer director. So I don't know why he gets such crap or why people feel so, I don't know, maybe because he doesn't seem cool to like something that's now popular. Maybe that's what it is. You know how, like, when you like something, when it's the fringe and then it becomes mainstream, everyone's like, oh, I don't like that anymore. It's sold out. Like, maybe our discussion will help bring some people to the surface and they'll start to wear their Tarantino fandom with pride.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope we can do this.
Well, let's talk about you for a second. Now, what is it that you do on your YouTube channel? And give us a little insight on your writing career. You seem to be doing a lot of things. You seem to be the Tarantino of my guests currently, doing 27 things at one time.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. This is awesome. Well, I don't know. Look, I'm a lover of art. And I'm an artist, okay? But to be an artist, you also have to live. So I work as a translator and a copy editor, which is okay. Work, you know, and it's good. I'm grateful for it, but it's not what fuels my soul. Fueling my soul is talking to people like you, just being open to the world, just hearing from all kinds of, like, my goal is to talk to many people about art, artists, and I've tried to put that into my channel, the J Days, where I just interview, you know, like cinematographers, costume designers, makeup and hair people, special effects people, just, you know, like actors who are like on the beginning, you know, like they're just appearing in their own movies and stuff like that. And for me, this has been an educational experience. Also, it kind of fuels me as a writer, because on the side, I'm also a writer. I wrote 2 books, poetry books,
oh, wow.
And I co-authored the book about wellness and stuff. I wrote an essay there, and I also proofread and edited the book. And I'm trying to write a script. I've been dying to do it for so long because I want to put myself out there. I want to have my vision exacted. I'm going to write a horror movie so good, and it's going to be, I tell you, very gory. Nothing tame. So, yeah, I think I'm just trying to live an artistic life and do all kinds of artsy things. So this is me in a nutshell.
That's awesome. Now, who's your biggest fish you've wrangled onto your show so far that you think might be someone down the road? They'll be going back to your channel to show them when they were younger about, you know, this is their start. Who do you think is the up-and-comer that you've had an opportunity to cross paths with?
I think I've had that glamorous set of guests. You know what I mean? I mean, all my guests are great. They're just awesome artists. But I've talked to some people, like cinematographer Bobby Witkowski was one of the best people I've talked to, because he gave me an insight into a world. Like, he worked, I think, as a gaffer on Dogfight starring River Phoenix. So imagine me, like the big River Phoenix fan, talking to someone who actually worked with him. He was the cinematographer on Land by Robin Wright. She starred and directed the movie. Imagine talking to that kind of mindset. I think I saw this recent film called Animal, and it starred a young actor. I will just send you the link of the interview after we finish. And when I saw this actor, okay, when I saw him in the movie, he was very darkened, and, you know, like, he was very playing a very grim character. And then the interview started, and I was like, oh my gosh, this guy is really handsome. I can see him going to places. And I was like, oh, okay, oh, good job, you know. Yeah, thank you for bringing this guy. So probably this, but I haven't had someone I feel like, well, maybe I will be surprised, because this is the beauty of life. When you, like, do an interview and, like, okay, good. And then 10 years later, what? This guy,
yes,
try to do it later on, maybe 10 years now.
Yeah, where are they now kind of segment, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just, I don't know, mainly it's just people behind the cameras, because I feel like this is where the actual magic works, but nobody talks to these people. I hope I can talk to directors, of course.
Yes,
who are like,
I know what you mean, yep. It's the people behind the cameras don't get enough. It's the people in front or directing that get a lot of the praise, but it takes a village, as they say, not just to raise a child, but to make a movie. It takes a lot of people to make it happen.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
Now, we are here to talk about the amazing Mia Wallace, played by Uma Thurman. Now, what is your personal connection to Mia? What were your initial impressions of her as a character? And has that changed over time?
No, honestly, the moment you see Mia Wallace, you just fall in love. What is this glorious? First of all, she's like smoking, and she's throwing all these smart. She's very smart. What I loved about the first thing, this is why I feel like the criticism at Tarantino is a bit like too much, because a lot of his women are smart. We are always complaining about stupid ditzy women in movies. He's like sitting with a guy, and he's saying all the things, and she's looking stupidly at him. Not Tarantino girls. Have you seen Jackie Brown, you guys? Have you seen The Bride? Oren, is she? All these awesome women, like, they're all smart, and the dialogue doesn't stop at them. You know what I mean? Like, it's not only the guy's dialogue, and then you have the stupid gal's dialogue. No, she's there at Vince, who looks so stupid in front of her. So what I loved about her is her brains, and her, of course, Bob, because it's so French, and I love French, you know, like,
yes,
Anna Karina, stuff like that. I love Anu Kimi, all these women. So it's so chic, and she's effortlessly chic. And this is something I think that I've never been able to in my entire life. So I like women who can do it. You know, like, she's so chic, but she's so, it's like she's doing like this. But, you know, there is an effort there. When you have an outfit like there, girl, come on, you've done something. So this is what I like about her. Her style, her mystique, her eyes, because Uma Thurman has a set of eyes that are just so, you know what I mean? So, yeah, this is what I love about her, and it hasn't changed because I think she's so iconic.
I would agree that that whole look, especially in the 90s, it changed a lot. A lot of people started to look a lot like Mia Wallace tried. And the amazing thing is played by Uma Thurman, whose hair couldn't be more blonde if you tried. It's as almost as blonde as the sun.
Yeah.
And what is striking is I've been, you know, researching to talk with you about it. I did a few, you know, researches watching her come on to like talk shows. She's extremely tall. She's around 6 feet tall. Like, she's a very tall woman. And it's weird because we see her in these movies and she doesn't look as tall. But then when she walks out on stage, sometimes you're like, oh my God, Uma Thurman is unbelievably tall. Maybe she just, you know, everyone she's with is tall. But, you know, like, if you think about it, when she's dancing with Travolta, they're almost eye to eye. They're almost the same height and they are barefoot. So it's not like she's in the heels. She's about the same stature and height as Travolta is in this film. And you're right. This movie, as we've talked about, it does so much of pop culture, but for fashion especially, and women's fashion, who would have thought? The outfit, which a lot of people don't realize, is her outfit is exactly what Jackie's wearing when we see Jackie, when she puts the suit on. She buys literally that outfit, and both of them kill it. Both of them kill it in that outfit. And maybe they're the beginning of the pantsuit revolution that came around. Maybe they were the first ones who kind of really made it chic to wear pantsuits, these power pantsuits. So that'd be one of the things Tarantino can, you know, say, hey, I was the first to make these power pantsuits. Exactly.
Mia. What's your thoughts on how to handle this?
What's yours?
Well, I'm of the opinion that if Marcel's lived his whole life, he don't need know nothing about this incident.
If Marcellus knew about this incident, I'd be in as much trouble as you.
I seriously doubt that.
I can keep a secret if you can.
Shake on it. Mom's a word.
Cool.
Now, if you excuse me, I'm gonna go home and have a heart attack.
Vincent, do you want to hear my Fox Force 5 joke?
Sure. Except I think I'm still a little too petrified to laugh.
No, you won't laugh because it's not funny. But if you still want to hear it, I'll tell it.
I can't wait.
Okay. Three tomatoes are walking down the street. Papa tomato, mama tomato, and baby tomato. Baby tomato starts lagging behind, and Papa tomato gets really angry, goes back and squishes him, says, ketchup. Ketchup. See you around.
And now, the AI psychological evaluation.
Now, you haven't had a chance to hear this because as we record, when listeners hear this, it's 3 months into the season. As we record, I am just a couple of days away from the very first one of these dropping. So the listeners will have heard how I do this section, and this will be your first time. But what I have done is I have asked AI to give us an analysis of Mia Wallace. So in order for us to better understand the psychological makeup of her, I turned to AI and asked to perform a psychological evaluation on her. And here are the results of that very evaluation.
Let's see.
Mia appears to be a confident, assertive, and sophisticated woman. Her demeanor suggests a level of self-assertiveness, possibly rooted in her social status and lifestyle. As the wife of a powerful and dangerous gangster, she may experience a sense of privilege and entitlement. While Mia seems to enjoy a luxurious lifestyle, she may also feel bored, lonely, or lacking meaningful emotional connections. Her choice of recreational activities, such as her interest in the adrenaline-filled experience of dancing at Jackrabbit Slim's and habitual cocaine use, hints at a desire for novelty and excitement. This could be indicative of a personality drawn to stimulation and sensation-seeking behaviors. Mia's interactions with Vincent Vega also reveal a complex emotional landscape. While she presents herself as composed and in control, there might be underlying vulnerabilities. Her fascination with Vincent and the subsequent dance contest may suggest a craving for connection and emotional intensity. Her attraction to Vincent, a hitman, suggests she may also be attracted to danger and excitement. She convinces Vincent to accompany her in for a nightcap, despite the risk due to her husband's violent nature. This could indicate a propensity for thrill-seeking behavior. Mia's overdose portrays a darker side of her, revealing potential risks associated with her lifestyle. It could be interpreted as manifestations of impulsive behavior or a lack of awareness of the consequences of her actions. It also signals underlying issues with substance use and impaired judgment. She may use drugs and danger as an escape from the emptiness of dissatisfaction with her lifestyle. Overall, Mia seems to exhibit signs of boredom, loneliness, attraction to danger, and impulsive behavior that may stem from deeper psychological motives. That is the amazing AI's ability to quickly scour what it knows of Mia on the internet and through the movie and come up with a diagnosis that does not cost me any money because I don't have to pay anybody. So what do you think about what we hear from the power of artificial intelligence to do something that I'm sure if I had the money could pay a psychologist to sit there and watch the TV and come up with? But what do we think? Has it hit on some key points? Has it kind of opened our eyes? Because I think as viewers, we go in, we watch the movie, and it's not until someone points something out, you go, oh my God, yeah, no, that feels exactly what I saw, you know? So what are your interpretations of what we just heard from our AI doctor?
Totally, and like totally, there's a lot that I think kind of touches from my analysis, because I do character analysis too, but nobody pays me, unfortunately. So yeah, I do this. For me, I think he hit on a lot of notes and a lot of stuff that I already written. You know what I love too about Mia? Especially, I think it's kind of like intersects with what AI said. The fact that she's toying with her husband's men. You know, like, imagine if this was a boring movie. She would have loved Vince and fallen for him. Tarantino knows best. He knows even women's psyche. Like, she's toying with these men. These men are disposable for her. You know, like, she's married to this gangster who scares her a little bit, but he also pampers her because he spoils her rotten, just as the AI said. So she's just flipping. You never know if she did this to, I think, Rocky Horror Tawny or whatever.
I know.
She keeps doing it to them, and she keeps, like, dragging them. The only thing that spared poor Vince is that she got entangled him with a mess, too. So I totally agree. She's out there. She's just engaging in these risky behaviors because she knows she's never going to get caught. Nobody's going to do anything to her. And she doesn't have even the emotional attachment to these men. Like, for her, they're just kind of like pawns on a chessboard. She's like moving them one and one, but there is nothing for her in it, like no emotional connection. And this is what I love about her. And this is what I feel like the AI touches on, of course, perfectly, because AI is smarter than us.
I like the fact that we talk about the loneliness, because in this film, we're going to get into it in a second, we're going to talk about her and Marcellus's relationship and lack possibly thereof one.
Of course.
Don't you hate that?
Hate what?
Comfortable silences. Why do we feel it's necessary to yak about bullshit in order to be comfortable?
I don't know. That's a good question.
That's when you know you found somebody really special. And you can just shut the fuck up for a minute, comfortably share silence.
So let's find out who Miss Mia Wallace is. Now, what we know about Mia is she's a former actress. She uses cocaine quite a bit. And she has somehow found herself the wife of a very powerful and dangerous crime boss. Where do we think she's from? And why do we think she moved to Hollywood? Now, the way she's played by Uma, she doesn't have an accent that would give us the impression that she is from the South. However, as we are well versed in, many actors come from different parts of the world, like Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are from Boston, and when they're home, that accent falls back in. But when they're not at home, they have learned to speak in, I would call, the common American English, where, you know, there's not too many mannerisms that make you feel like, oh, they're from this place, unless, of course, we do have a story that's from said place. So she at least plays it as a very good actress, where it would be very hard for us to pick out what part of the world or country she came from. But where do we think maybe she did come from? And why do we think she moved to Hollywood?
For me, where she came from, I'm going to leave it to you. You'll be so much better than me because I could say, New Jersey. Yeah. And then I don't know.
It would be great if she suddenly had that, like, New Jersey. What's fucking wrong with you? It's also like she says, you know, what the fuck's wrong with you over there? That would be great.
Oh, I know. She's from LA. Alaska, of course. You know, yeah. And I don't know shit. I don't really know. For me, but the fact that she came to Hollywood, hello, a girl mm-hmm. with her looks, with her height, of course she wouldn't want to work like all the stories we hear. She's been seen by someone, or she just values herself so much. And she's like, oh, I'm going to try my luck. You know, I'm going to model. I'm going to be an actress. A girl like Mia was born for these kind of like superficial industries. You know what I mean? Like this mm-hmm. would be in my mind. The girl with her looks, of course, she wouldn't bother going and working long hours and being tired unless she's a waitress. So of course she would go to Hollywood.
Do we think, and again, this is just spitballing here. Obviously, when Uma was actually cast, she was in her early 20s, I believe. Because I think I saw just the other day, like recently, she just turned 50, which like makes me feel very old. It's like, how the hell is Uma Thurman 50 years old?
No.
And, but if we look at, like, I think John Travolta's in his 60s, 70s. So he was about 15 to 20 years older than her when they did this role. And Bing Rhames is a little younger than John Travolta, but I think was still a little bit older than Uma.
Yeah.
So since it's the way it was cast, we can only go with what we have and the information that's on the screen without totally knowing. Do we think maybe she's has a bad or strained relationship with her dad, and maybe one of the reasons she left to prove them wrong? Just going to spitball, Midwest part of the country, not the Bible Belt, but Midwest, blue collar, Protestant American values. Runs away, has enough. Maybe dad's not in the picture. Maybe dad's a tyrant. Maybe he's an asshole. Maybe a preacher. You know what I mean? Something that forces her to be rebellious. But I'm feeling maybe the dad's not in the picture, which is why she finds herself attracted to older men.
Yeah.
Again, this is just spitballing. I don't know for a fact. I don't want to be crucified. But anyone listen to this? I'm trying to be. But if you go with generalizations, right?
You're like, anti-feminist. You're stereotyping.
This feels like the kind of, especially from the 90s, it feels like that kind of getting back at my father, looking for a father type figure, much like Bill does in Kill Bill. Bill is always trying to find male figures because he doesn't have a dad, you know, and similar with Tarantino, doesn't have a father. So his love of people were his mom's boyfriends. That's where he gets all his kind of knowledge from. I'm just saying, maybe she runs away to Hollywood. As you said, she is pretty. We know she's got long legs, obviously, because she's tall, which is weird because I said to you, you don't notice that when you're watching the movie, but
films.
When you see her later, you're kind of like, oh my God, she really is tall.
And her feet too.
Yeah. And so I'm 100% for this. She uses her assets, so to speak, for her best benefit. Why wouldn't she? Why does anyone give anyone crap for that? When if you are given or certain aspects that people will fall in line for or literally wait on you hand and foot, why would anyone be upset? Or why would anyone, you know, begrudge a person to use them? Because if we had them, we would use them. You know what I mean? I think I'm saying the people who are upset with it are the people who don't have it.
This is the thing. Of course. I'd look like that. I'd do it. You know, like I look like Leonardo DiCaprio. I'd be like going on with all those rich women. Let them pay my rent.
Exactly. Exactly. I know. I don't know why people fight that. We would all do it if we had the ability to. Yeah, but we're upset and surly because we don't have that ability. And it didn't happen to us. So we're like, oh, that's bullshit.
Yeah, beauty privilege. Yeah. But I do about it. I complain a lot. But I love it still. I love this so much. You're totally right.
I think this is what, you know, maybe... Again, and this is one of my favorite things as we're talking about. I think maybe before we start recording, I can't remember now. We've been 20 minutes in and I've already lost my mind. But she is the probably one of the most mysterious characters next to the Gimp. Like maybe the Gimp is the only character we really want more information on. We're like, how did life land you here?
I know.
And we will cover the Gimp. He's the last one of this series in December. Nothing like a Christmas with a Gimp. So we'll try to figure out what happened with him. But outside of the Gimp, it really is Mia because... We don't get a lot of information, but we get a lot of information. You know, it's that weird, like, we learn a lot about Mia, but we still are so in the dark as to how she got where she is. How did her and Marcellus meet? You know, that's another question I have for you. How do we think they met? Did maybe Marcellus have some money in the game of producing TV shows and maybe it was a Hollywood party? Because he doesn't feel like the kind of guy, based on who he is as a gangster, he's not street level, but he's not a power broker type mafia person in Hollywood, but he's in that middle ground. Like he's definitely got some, he definitely can pull some strings to have some things happen. Like he may like be like a Tony Soprano. Like he can run like the Teamsters Union there and get them to shut down a production and maybe get someone a job, but he's not like, you know, running Hollywood type of thing. So she probably meets him at some kind of like, I don't want to say B-list act, but like a B-list actor kind of party. Maybe she's gone there to try to hobnob and maybe get in with a producer or something like that.
Definitely. I totally agree with this interpretation. I can see it happening because I've even known things like this happening. You know what I mean? So yeah, it totally makes sense. Like a girl I like her with her abilities, with her level, of course, of, you know, like, because, you know, Hollywood, the levels, even when you get to this level, and then there are the higher parties, and there are the middle shitty parties. So definitely she was in one of those in between. It was all in between. It was a space in between. You're not talking about high level producer, you know, like even the high level mobsters who are like controlling Hollywood, but at the same time, it's not something like trashy. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, not seedy.
In the middle of it. Exactly, exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah, she wasn't going to debase herself. And I don't mean this against anyone who's been in these movies or whatever. She wasn't going to debase herself in the Hollywood porn scene. It's different nowadays. I know that where we are now, we have OnlyFans and stuff. And that's a completely different person runs their own, whatever they want to do for themselves. That's a completely different. You being your own steward of your career as opposed to going and having to live a seedier life back in the day of the VHS and the video days. So it's a little different, you know, going out to Hollywood and being an OnlyFans person and instead going out there for that. And I think Mia sees herself too high.
Exactly.
Do we think she gets with Marcellus, even though she probably realizes he's a gangster? Because although he's a gangster, he is probably has more of a code than a Hollywood producer would, and probably won't throw her aside as quickly as a Hollywood producer would, as like 2-3 years, new, I know this sounds awful, I do apologize, but something newer and younger comes along and she goes and someone else is in, you know? And Marcellus is gonna, she doesn't have to do anything to keep her status with him.
Exactly, the beautiful trophy wife, and nothing will happen, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. We're meeting here. I've always worried that my thoughts sometimes like, all right, this is, people are going to shoot this down. They're going to think I'm some chauvinist, but I'm just trying to read the tea leaves of if I were her, why would I pick Marcellus Wallace over some seedy Weinstein type? And even though he murders people, there is a code. If he murdered you, you broke the code. Whereas in Hollywood, it really is sometimes the weather changes and you're gone.
There is no morals there. She needs her stability. Like from what you just said about the daddy issues and the abandonment and stuff, Mia still has a fragile side that she hides perfectly. She doesn't show it, but she is afraid of being out there, you know, like, so she needs that kind of stability, that kind of security. And it also nurtures a part of her. You know what I mean? Like, I know. You could see her like daddy him all the time. And you could see her being this lovely pet in his life. But at the same time, she also doesn't want him all the time in her face. So she kind of gets rid of him, you know, like, and he's out there doing his ventures. He's not pushing her to, you know, like, look younger, go, do stuff. You know what I mean? Like, if a regular producer would have done this to her. So I think Mia is far more intelligent than a lot of people would give her credit for. So this is why she got entangled with Marcellus. And at the same time, her risk-taking behavior and her, you know, like, whatever is driving her mentally to do this wouldn't make her scared of him because, you know, another girl would have been scared, but not me. I think she's kind of ballsier than that. So, yeah. So it was like a perfect pairing.
I agree. And she becomes a queen. Like, it's the closest that she can be to royalty because he's a mob boss. Even Vincent says, I'm not a fucking idiot. That's the big man's wife. Like, she's become, not like property, but like, everyone knows. There's even stories. We don't even know what truly happened with Tony. But we know what could have happened with Tony. We know what happens if it even is a whisper that it happened. A man was thrown off a balcony for touching your feet. And that's why Vince knows if she dies tonight, far worse things are going to happen to me. You know, it's like far worse things are going to happen to me. So we'll get into it in a second. But I think she, you know, she was probably trying to find a Hollywood way. And then she, like you said, she's very smart. She used her beauty to ensnare a man that would give her comfort and protection for,
exactly.
You know, again, when she marries him, she thinks he's probably invincible. I mean, as we found out, Marcellus was this close to not being invincible. A lot of things happened to Marcellus. Unfortunate things happened to Marcellus.
This sequence is like the scariest for me. Like, this is one of the most violent aspects of Quentin. When you think about, you know, like other movies, it feels funny. But this one is like the one where you're like, oh my God, I can't even imagine. Poor guys. You feel bad for these, you know, like evil guys, like these badasses. Like, you see them so vulnerable. And it's so, I love Quentin. He's just amazing.
Yeah, because we don't see them as bad guys, good guys. We see them as people even we might know. And that if we had taken a step or two the other way, we might actually be ourselves. They're humanized. They're not just like, you know, and The Godfather is a phenomenal movie. I love The Godfather. But they feel like untouchable characters. They're rich. They're powerful. They're the top. They're people that we can't even fathom being. And most people can't. We have no idea what it's like, but we can see ourselves as being a Vince, as being a Jules, as being Mia, as being Butch, as being Marcellus. We can see ourselves in them because they're more, and just like why I think The Sopranos was such a great show. You can see yourself as a part of The Sopranos, as part of the, as Tony and all these people, because it's more realistic to us. The up on the shiny hill, the people, the one percenters that, you know, it's almost unfathomable. Like Wolf of Wall Street to me is a world that I could never imagine being a part of. Like, I would never see myself ever landing in that kind of position. However, some other places like this, I can see myself being like, oh no, yeah, I can see myself
Breaking
in the Jackie
Bad
Brown world.
Breaking Bad being one of them.
Breaking Bad being one, yes.
You know, like Walter White, you know, like the tormented genius.
Yes.
Did something bad because you don't value me. I'm so smart for this stupid small life. But yeah, this stupid small life was good, that bastard.
Yeah, exactly.
It all at the end.
Yeah, it's the more relatable characters. And that's like, I'm not taking anything away from The Godfather. It's a spectacular film.
Who are we
talking? But what I'm saying is I can never see myself as the Corleones. You know what I mean? That's just, I can see myself more as a Soprano than a Corleone because it's more.
Me too. I can see myself as Walter White, definitely. Or Jesse,
yes,
because, you know,
yes,
like, I get slapped on the head all the time. I can be a scientist in many stories. So yeah, I totally get it. But Godfather, who would I be? Michael Corleone, daughter of, you know, like a bar. Hello.
Yeah.
It's like, you know. But yeah, I totally get it.
But, you know, I think that's why Tarantino resonates with so many people is, and has helped to, like Breaking Bad, they are very big fans of his and took a lot of influence and references from him in Breaking Bad. But they found a way to create a character that's very realistic. We are allowed to walk in gray matter when we have these characters. Like with Mia, we feel for her, but we also see that she is playing a dangerous game. She loves her life, but she's bored with it. You know, we see that she's walking with danger every step. She's firewalking every step of her way. And we can feel that because there are times that we feel the same.
A lot.
Hi, Vincent. I'm getting dressed. The door's open. Come inside and make yourself a drink. Mia.
Hello.
Billy Ray was the preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered,
Vincent. Vincent. I'm on the intercom.
Where is the intercom?
It's on the wall by the two African fellows. To your right. Warm. Warmer. Disco.
Hello?
Push the button if you want to talk.
Hello?
Go make yourself a drink, and I'll be down in two shakes of a lamb's tail. The bar's by the fireplace.
Okay.
But let's dive into the relationship she does and or doesn't have. And let's start with her husband, Marcellus. As is well documented anywhere on the internet, so this isn't just me coming up with this. I don't want people to think that, like, sometimes, like, you know, I research a lot of things, and there's things I've seen myself, but I don't want people to think that, like, I just think I'm the all knowledge of the internet on Tarantino. I am not.
Oh, yes, Toddy. You know,
I know everything. But no, Marcellus, in this film, not once does Marcellus and Mia have any kind of even interchange vocally, let alone really anything that would give you the impression that they're in a, I don't want to say they're in a bad relationship, because the scene where Jules is trying to, he eventually sends the wolf to help out in the Bonnie situation. Mia's been in the pool. She's walking. They're eating breakfast. I highly doubt she's made the breakfast, but maybe she has. We never do see, like, if there's a maid or anything like that. So I don't want to just assume that she didn't, but given the lifestyle, there's a good chance she didn't make it. Ladies, I'm not saying that Mia Wallace is incapable of making her own meal. I'm just saying, if she's the queen, why the fuck is she cooking?
Wouldn't do it.
I'm just saying, why is she?
Status.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If she's his queen, he's got money, she's not cooking.
Exactly.
I'm just saying, she's not. Because otherwise, this doesn't feel like it's the right story. But they're sitting there, and she's like, you know, she's fine to be in his company, and he knows she's there, but they look like an old married couple. There's not a lot of, like, interchanges. Like, there's not a touch. Like, she doesn't put her hand on him, and he, or, you know, there's none of that silent communication of affection to one another. At the boxing thing, obviously, this is an extreme. He's been double-crossed. He's pissed off. She's not one of those dumb women who pretend they don't know what their husband is. She fully knows what the fuck he does.
Definitely.
Fully knows. And it's fully into it. Which I like about her. Same with Carmella. She's a Carmella Soprano.
Very.
She knows what he fucking does, and she's fine with it. She doesn't pretend. She doesn't pretend like she doesn't know where his money comes from.
As long as it gets us the Dow, you know, like, it's okay, baby. She does. I think Mia's moral compass is more complex than that. You know what I mean? Like, hello, it's just pain. You know, like, she doesn't care. And she knows what she entangled herself with. She's not kind of this, like, oh, I don't know. What happened? What are you doing? No, that's not her.
No. And she's probably rationalized as, like, look, he's doing criminal stuff. The people he's doing it with are criminals themselves. If people get hurt, that's just the world they're in. You know, like, she's fine with it. Like, I appreciate that about her. I appreciate someone who's grounded in their own events, and they're not, like, damsels in distress or victims of their own decisions. Like, I didn't know. I mean, I just thought he carried a gun for protection.
Like, oh, stop it. Please just stuff your mouth or something. Spare us these.
He threw that man into that garden because he was a gardener. You know, it's like, yeah, it's, you know, it's like even the in Goodfellas, even Ray Liotta's wife there, when they're at the wedding, she knew what was going on. He didn't get all that money for nothing. She knew what was happening. You know, I like someone who's grounded in their own reality and don't pretend that it's something that's not.
I like people who are like very realist. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know how the world goes around. I married a guy and he gets a lot of money. Hello. Like, either he's doing criminal activity, or he inherited something from his uncle in Brazil, which wouldn't happen. Fuck it, you know, like, either leave the guy, or just, you know, like, chill and live with it. So, I don't like people who are, like, victimizing their lives. I just, ugh. Even characters.
If you enjoy wearing the jewels, don't be surprised what kind of blood was spilled for the jewels. It's, you know, as the White Stripes say in one of their songs, you can't be the pimp and the prostitute, too. You gotta be one or the other. You can't be both. Yeah, you gotta pick a side. But we don't get the feeling that they're in a very, I don't want to say it's a marriage of convenience, because that just, I don't think that's what it was. There's just not a lot that we can go on from the moments we see her. He's very protective. We know that. And she even uses that as a threat. Like, I believe my husband, your boss, told you to take me out and do whatever I want to do. I want to dance. I want that trophy. You know what I mean? It was kind of like basically threatening Vincent. Like, look, this date goes one of two ways. You dance, or your legs get fucking broken. Your fucking choice, pal. So she knows the power that he wields. So I think she likes that. But I don't know that there's much more. I think work is more important to Marcellus. Definitely. And she may just be. I mean, I think he loves her. I think he likes her. I mean, you don't throw a man off a balcony just out of jealousy. No. You know what I mean? Like,
there's a lot going on there. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot. Like, I wish we could. There's not enough information from the movie. I wish we could. Does it get AI to find out what's going on with the electric? Because I tried. There just isn't enough. Yeah.
Analyze this couple.
Yeah. There's just not enough information for the, you know, to get a full kind of reading. But it makes sense why she might be attracted to Vince. And there's attraction, and it not right off the bat, but it definitely starts. She's intrigued when she meets him, but it definitely starts when they get to the restaurant. I think a lot of it is that, you know, we don't know how long they've been married, but there's just such, there's an emptiness. There's something missing. There's a loneliness. There's a something component missing, which gets her to, as you say, kind of maybe look at his men.
Exactly.
Again, I don't want to put her in a scarlet letter kind of thing, but at the same time, humans have needs.
You know,
and sometimes, if you're not getting something from somebody.
Think about it. Like, this girl has got a lot on her plate. She got a lot of stuff. But at the same time, this is never, and it's, nothing is ever enough. This is what I love about, you know, characters like that. She got a lot. She got protection. She got money. She can spend any time. She's living in this amazing house on her own. Nobody's bothering her or bugging her, you know. It's not like a Christian Grey, you know, like, you have to do this for me and Ben. No, he's leaving her to live her life, to be her beautiful self. And he's like her daddy. And he's like giving her this protective vibe and stuff. But then what? You know, like, days go and years, and she doesn't love this man. You know what I mean? Even love sometimes is not enough. So what about if there was not love? It was attraction, you know, like, it was a very good deal made. You know, like, I need your power. I need your youth and beauty. I need you together. So they just gather together. This is why you could feel they have relative peace, because they know what they want from each other. These are not like, she's not even having these stupid expectations about living with him. She knows exactly what she wants from him and what he wants from her. But at the same time, then what? The days go, and which is why she's like snorting cocaine, like one after the other, because there's nothing there. There's a beautiful, secure, kind of like apple pie life, but it's very sheltered. There's nothing. There's nothing else. So she tries her luck with danger with these men, whom she feels are so inferior to her and her husband. And if someone of them kind of crosses a line a little bit, she just goes and tells her husband, you know, like, oh, he bugged me, he did this. Mm-hmm. She's so manipulative, and she's so smart. She's like controlling this world from her room. You know what I mean? Like watching people, like her first encounter with Vince. So I don't know. For me, it feels like, of course, she's empty. Of course, she feels nothing. Of course, she needs to fill up this gap in her soul. But it's not like poetic kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's more of a reality hurts. Reality hits. You've got everything, but there's always something missing.
She's almost created her own prison of convenience. You know, like she's got everything she wants, but there's always two sides to a coin. Sometimes, you know, men don't always have the, I don't think many humans have the ability to be everything all at once. It's impossible. A lot of times you're formed a certain way. And if you're a tough guy, you're not always the sensitive guy that the woman wants. If you're the sensitive guy the woman wants, but then you want you're someone with a backbone, you don't have the guy, you know what I mean? So you get the wet blanket or you get the rock of stone. Like, it, you know, it's a weird way, but it's just sometimes who it is. And that's who Marcellus is. Marcellus is the rock that she knows is always going to have protect her and take care of her, but may not always give her the attention she's seeking. And I think, as we talk about Vincent now, I think she was intrigued by Vincent, which is why when we watch him, she's finding out about him. And of course, he shows up still coming off his high of heroin. So fucking, what a fucking idiot. Like, of all the nights you don't show up to the date, you don't get high before you go out with the boss's wife. Like, it just seems like that's something I covered that in the first that you'll hear. The people have already heard. You'll hear it on this Friday, but they've already heard it. But it's just like that. What the fuck, man? Why are you showing up high to this very important thing you've been tasked with? And as we talked on that, we think that Vincent was tasked with it because there is more to this Tony Rocky horror thing than meets the eye. It's not as cut dry as shook my hand. No. Not be as vicious as the foot massage, but there is something. He didn't throw him off a balcony and keep him alive. It was a warning. And the reason he sends Vincent is because I think Vincent's higher up in the organization and he trusts Vincent. Whatever he was doing in Amsterdam was something where he really earned his trust. And you can tell because why I know women get a bad rap for always gossiping. Men, we have our own little... We know information too. And that's why at the bar.
Men gossip a lot and I hate it.
Well, when they both said, "Have you met Mia yet?" And they both, they know there's more, like, they know that Mia has gotten some people in trouble before.
Yes.
That he's, if he's not careful, he's the next Tony Rocky Horror.
Exactly.
And that's why they laugh. And that's why even Vince is kind of like a little nervous. So she sees Vince. And I think she's like enamored. Oh, okay, this is someone different, you know? Plus, she probably knows she just got back from Amsterdam. So he's like completely new. This is a brand new, I don't want to say toy. That sounds terrible. But it's like a brand new, like, I don't know anything about him. I've never met him before. He's completely a mystery.
I tell you what it is. Yeah, it's for her, it's like the higher the conquest. Like, oh my gosh, Marcellus is a stupid man. Yeah. Ooh, Vince.
Yeah, like, yeah. Who's, you know, this guy? I mean? Yes, yes.
This is the thing.
He's rolling his own cigarette. That impresses her. Like, there's certain things he does. He has an air of coolness without trying to be cool. And I think that he's not even trying. Like, he's not trying to win her over at all. He just can eat my food, laugh at her jokes, drive her home, and go fucking home and just do exactly what Marcellus has asked me to do. And I think she starts to, as she starts to sit there, and the first moment we know that she is intrigued by him is that awkward silence comment she makes. And it's a great callback when they go back to the house. But when she makes that comment, you go, oh, I'm going to help some men out listen to this. Women drop clues, gentlemen. We're just too fucking dumb sometimes to pick them up. That is a total clue. Now listen, when I say clues and interest, don't take it as like it's a clue that they want you right then and there. Like, exactly. Let's
take it down, baby. Yeah, slow down.
Bring down the expectations a hair. Yes, they have an interest possibly in you. Doesn't mean
the
things are
happening. Try to read the signs. You know, like, try to read the signs. Exactly.
But when she says that, because he's just sitting there smoking, like, he's just kind of, like, taking in the whole restaurant. He's still at the end of his high. So he's, you know, he's still not all there, but he's, like, taking in this, like, this is such a cool restaurant. Like, he's really enjoying this, and she's getting even more enamored with him because he's not focusing on her. And I know that's a weird thing, but there's a push-pull thing with women when if the focus is all... It's not fun. It's not, you want a little bit of a game, a little chase. And when he's just kind of like cool as shit, he's like, yeah, cool. I'm smoking.
Because I feel like we're giving like dating advice to listeners. I want to throw in my two cents too. Some guys overdo it, you know, like, and he completely ignores you, you know, like, to the extent of being kind of an asshole. And some women surprisingly fall for that.
Yeah.
Some women actually get pissed off. So it's a very complex world, you know. Like some women are like, oh my gosh, you're overdoing it, buddy, stop it. But other women are like, oh, he's ignoring me. Oh, yeah. He's being good. I love it. So some men kind of overdo it. Some men are like naturally just, you know, like maybe it's
his turn. He's completely clueless to what's going on.
And she's like, wow. But Mia, because I think she's been with a lot of men and she's really good at treating people, mm-hmm. from what I perceive, she knows he's not faking it. And this is what's intriguing her. Like, oh my God, that's surreal.
Which is why she has to go powder her nose. Because we're going to get into this. This is what this is for. We're talking about. This is the major one I wanted to talk about. It's her and Vince. You will actually be joining me this season later. We're actually going to talk about this very scene even more in depth. So I don't want to give too much of my cards away.
Yeah.
But I feel that Mia was getting herself some courage to possibly, if things kept going in a way, possibly walking the very dangerous line. The very dangerous line. Even though we just had a conversation where she shoots Vince down saying that he just touched my hand at my wedding. And Vince like, oh, all right, but listen, if you say so, I'm not going to question this shit. But there was definitely something about her because she's intrigued by Vince because he's different. He's completely different than Marcellus. And besides the fact of skin color, that's not what I mean when I say he's different. He is different in just attitude and mood. I mean, Marcellus is business. He is a straight shooter. He is intimidating. That's how Vincent is scared. The only person not scared of Marcellus, and we talked about this last month, is Jules. Jules is not scared of anybody. It's the only human being
Jules
he's not scared of.
Fearless. He's fearless. Insane. Jules,
yeah,
he's awesome.
Because in the moment when him and Vince are talking, and he's like, I bet he laughs in my face. I don't give a gung, but fuck if he does laugh in my face. He's just like, I don't fucking care about Marcellus. And I think Marcellus noticed that about him, which is why he's not as high on the totem pole, because I think he fears that Jules wanted to take the throne. Maybe Jules could take the throne. You know, so
maybe
that's why he holds
him
down.
See that.
But Vincent is like petrified of Marcellus. Well, he has a deep respect because he also knows that if he crosses him, he knows he's not to be toyed with. And I think we even learn that, even though we don't see what happens to Tony Rocker Horror, we learn that from what happens to him. When Butch frees him, we realize early, Marcellus, what happened to him is awful, but he's still, he's like, you're going to wish you'd killed me. You know what I mean? Like you're going to wish you had killed me. You had me, and now you let me free. Shit's going to get worse. And I think he becomes a worse human being post that. You know what I mean? I don't think Marcellus has a revelation. I think Marcellus gets a lot more medieval because how dare someone cross him?
What happened to him?
Yes.
Exactly.
He calls in all the markers. Whoever's pissed him off is in fucking serious trouble after these events.
Goodbye.
Yeah. He may be one of the few people who can be prison raped like that and then turn around and make it like, that's it. Everybody is going to pay.
Exactly.
But I do think that there's a real moment in that they have, and it's when the dancing happens. And what I loved about the dancing is usually that animalistic kind of peacock flaring. It's like when we talk about this, the rubbing the feet. It's a very sexual thing that no one likes to talk about.
Exactly.
Right? Like when we dance, there's this, it's almost feeling each other out if there could be chemistry, if there could be a lot of things. But I love how then when they dance, it's a very, like he dancing versus he knows. Not to, it's a twist contest. So if you're grinding in a twist contest, you're not in a twist contest. You're doing something else and you're doing it wrong.
Exactly.
But he keeps his face very serious. Like he's in the moment. He's almost thinking like, I've got to win this dance. I've got to dance, you know, and she kind of mirrors him.
Mary.
When they walk up the driveway and there's the dip moment. And then he's mentions, now we know he's in. When he mentions it, that's our cue that he's got something for her. Oh, then he does what all men do. And it's, you put your foot in your mouth and he goes, I got to take a piss. It's like, man, that just kills the mood. It's just
like too much information.
Yeah. She's like, drinks. Music goes, I got to take a piss. And she's like, little more piss. you're just thinking, God damn it, Vince, you're such an idiot. You were doing so well. You're doing so well. You were so smooth. You didn't even know you were smooth. Now you're a fucking idiot. Just dropping the ball. But there is definitely, and again, she goes to get a drink. Like, there's signs. There are signs, if you want to see them,
exactly, that
things could happen. However, we talked about this on our episode for Vince, My guest there, Petros Pat. So he believes, and I kind of actually echo him now. I wasn't sure if I felt the same in the moment, but now I've had some time to ruminate on it. He doesn't think, regardless if she ODs or not, uh-huh. He doesn't think that Vince would have, even if Mia was going to throw herself at him.
Yeah.
He believes, and I think I believe him too, Vince was going to leave. Because when he does come walking out, he is coming out anyways out of the bathroom. And you remember, he's like, all right, Mia, I got to get going. Like, he is going to be loyal, which is why I think Marcellus picked him in the first place. He even's in there in the bathroom scene talking himself down.
Yeah.
He goes, you're just going to go home, you're going to jerk off, that's all you're going to do. Listen to the episode if you haven't yet, but we think he may have possibly done that before he left.
I'm going to argue with you a little bit.
Fire away.
But what if she's like, what if he came out of the bathroom and saw her naked? Like, what if she was like naked and sitting like a goddess? Wouldn't he have done it? What if she surprised
him? Well, to not be crude, because you haven't heard the episode yet, but my listeners have. So I will cue you in with Erdy now. Myself and Petros actually believe, because he was in there a very long time, we actually think he may have taken care of himself there, which is why it takes. And when he comes out,
coming out feeling pure, like
well, this is awful. He's coming out with some clarity, because when he does come out, he is very calm.
He's very kind of
like, all right, Mia, I gotta get going. Like, he is like, you know, like he has this like
eyes are conflict like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he knew that if he. I know. I don't want to be crude.
She would have been insane. He would have been like, I think, worse than what happened to Tony Rocky.
Well, we also made a thing that because he comes out and then she's overdosing, so now I think she's in worse trouble. If he had sex with her, he may have actually got away with that. Like that may have actually been a safer moment for him.
Gotta argue.
Than when she comes walk out because she's not ODing.
Yeah.
If she dies on drugs,
yeah,
go ahead.
Okay. I feel that Mia deliberately exposes this guy. Like, at some point, like, maybe while eating breakfast, you know, like, I don't like the way Vince has been, you know, I feel like she's mean like that. Like, I feel she has a little deviousness inside of her. Like, I feel she exposes it. Like, it could have gone unnoticed for a lot of guys. This is in my mind because I feel like she's been doing it with a lot of guys. A lot of those guys were thrown off the balconies. But I feel like she...
Tony's not the first, and he wasn't the last. A lot of guys are learning to fly here in L.A., the Marcellus Wallace flight school.
Yes. This is my instinct. So I feel like he would have gotten exposed because I don't trust Mia. I feel like she's... So yes, when you said that he held his guards, he must have felt, you know, like, oh my gosh, she's going to betray me. So no, I'm not going to do it. So I kind of go with your theory. He knows he's going to be fucked if he fucked her. No matter what, even if it goes unnoticed, he doesn't trust this lady. Like, he feels it. So when he goes out and she's ODing, if she's dead, there is no escape from this brother at all.
I think she might go even further. I don't think she'd give him up. I think now she's got him under her thumb, and now
he would be like even more devious.
Do whatever she wants. I mean,
he'd be her slave or give.
Because she threatened him. She threatened him just for dancing. You know, look, it was playful. I know it's playful.
Still,
we all know when words are used, even when we say they're playful, we do have a meaning to them.
Yeah.
We're just saying them nicer. She was kind of saying, look, if you don't do what I asked you to do, I'm going to tell Marcellus. And that's all he had to hear.
Boom.
So from that moment on, if you don't do this for me, I'm going to tell Marcellus. And so she would have had him under thumb. And maybe Tony Rocky Horror didn't want to have that happen. Although, and I don't want to be mean, but they say he's big. So maybe Tony came on to her. Maybe he did come on to her a little bit. And maybe she feels ashamed that she was maybe grossed out by him. And look, we have no idea what Tony Rocky Horror looks like. So please don't anyone yell at me like I'm body shaming. We don't even know this man's invisible and imaginary. He's not real. I'm not making fun of an actor, human being, or an actor. We have no idea what Tony Rocky Horror looks like. He's never been seen on screen. So please don't get mad at me.
We haven't seen him, guys. Yeah.
But she did say that, you know, like everyone says he's bad. What's his name said, you know, even when they're talking about him, he's a big guy. Maybe Tony did come on to her. Maybe she was trying to use her feminine charm to get him to do things for her, not in a sexual manner. But, you know, he used her beauty to get her what she needs. I mean, men, we fall for it all the time. So why, again, I have no qualms with her doing said things. But maybe he became a little inappropriate. Maybe he got a little too tit for tat type of person. Well, I'm doing this for you. What are you going to do for me? And she put him in check.
She's like, no, but I'm the boss's wife, bitch.
But Tony must be high enough, or he must be something enough where he didn't cross the line to get killed, but he was probably used as a Cautionary tale.
Exactly.
Cross me this way, even the littlest thing, and I will throw your fucking ass off a fucking balcony through a fucking greenhouse. You survive, good for you. If you don't, exactly. Sucks too. Whatever. What are you going to do about it? You're not going to do goddamn anyway. So there you go.
Yeah.
And I don't know that in the moment she thought that, but I think she was definitely enamored by Vincent. I think maybe more. But you have to listen to our episode coming up later in the beginning of summer when we actually jump into the talking about a pulpy romance, when we actually do a full-on episode talking about the Jackrabbit Slim's date and the damn near aftermath that got everyone killed. I do love the fact, though, that how do you make sleeping with a big man's wife more terrifying than doing that? I don't know. Letting her die in drugs that you shouldn't have had in your pocket and brought to the thing. That's worse. Like, honestly, if he had walked in on them having sex, it would have been better than him having to explain to her, him, how she died in his company.
Exactly. There's nothing for him. He wouldn't have been, you know, like thrown off the balcony, baby. Maybe it would be a gimp somewhere.
Exactly. Even Jules and them would have been like, look, I get it. She's a honeypot. I get why he did it. But if you hear, like, how did Vincent get killed? He let her overdose. Like, people are like, what the fuck's wrong? Like, that's, I know it's dumb, but it does feel like the worst thing you could do is like, dude, you shouldn't sleep with his wife, but it's understandable because of what she was doing. But to let her overdose?
OG,
what are you doing? Exactly.
You're doomed, brother. There's no saving for you.
So Tony Rocky Horror, definitely there's more to him than meets the eye. More to that story, which is one of the beauties of movies and why a well-written script contains things that we don't need answers for. It's fun. We're having a podcast 30 years later talking about what the fuck happened with Tony Rocky Horror. Who is this guy? Why was he thrown off a balcony? Just like what's in the case, these are things about Marcellus we may never fucking have the answer for. And we don't need the answers. Because sometimes it's the conversation that it leads to afterwards that makes it better than just us knowing exactly what happened. It's fun. It's fun to have a conversation. We could be right. We could be wrong. We don't know.
Yeah, we never know.
Now, we've kind of discussed the date with Vincent. Her overdose. Now, again, once again, that is a petrified moment. Do we think after her overdose, her near death, I'll be honest, even in the theater, and I had heard about the adrenaline shot scene, because before you got to go to the movie, it had already premiered in New York, and everyone had heard, and I think, there is no such thing as bad press. And honestly, if you're Tarantino and you find out that someone has passed out and needs to stop the film, and even though I think I remember talking about it on the episode in season one, I actually think the person was more of a diabetic thing where they hadn't eaten enough and it just happened to be like the timing, you know, they kind of got sweaty and nervous and that was the timing. But at the time, that's not what was reported. It was reported that scene cause someone to faint and then stop the show in New York City to get them medical attention. So, I mean, you go into the movie waiting for this scene.
I need this movie.
Yes. And you have no, I mean, even when he does, I did not know if Mia was going to live or not. Like, you did not know the stakes of that moment.
Because there was no social media. If there was, you would know, spoiler alert, she died.
Yeah.
Or after you see the movie, she lives. You'll never have this feeling again. Excitement, you know, like you're reading the papers, like someone passed out watching a movie. Ooh, I gotta go and watch. Wow.
Yes.
So you're never gonna have this again.
No. Or as I tell people, if you have a movie coming out you want to see, put your phone away for days. Don't go on your social media. There's no need to. Wait, go see the movie, and then jump on the social media. Don't let some asshole ruin it for you. Don't let some clown ruin it for you. Just a little tip from the Church of Tarantino.
Exactly.
But do we think that after the overdose, does she get her shit together? Because, I mean, the way they both act, the end of that scene, that when he drops off, she gets to tell the joke and he does a little blow the kiss and he knows like, she could have been something, but wow, I dodged the bullet.
Exactly.
Do we think she's changed? Do we think that maybe that's a wake-up call for her? Because the main scene where he gets the drugs from Lance and Lance says, I'm all out of balloons. Can we use baggies?
Baggies.
I'm not a big drug person, but I did work in undercover drug work when I was younger in the military. Heroin.
What? Wow.
Yes.
So cool.
I thought I talked about it before, but I have no idea. Heroin is usually transported in balloons and cocaine is usually in baggies. And that's why that is key. She thinks it's cocaine and she thinks she's bumping a hit of cocaine and she doesn't. She takes heroin and she ODs on it. So that's a key moment. It looks like this is the first time she's ever overdosed, possibly. Yeah. Like, she's pretty fucked up from it. This isn't like a thing like, oh, this happened before.
No.
She's pretty fucked up from it. He's fucked up from it. We'll never know if John stops doing heroin because he's killed a couple days later. Spoiler alert. Sorry, 30 years since this came out, in case you didn't know. But do you think that Mia changes her ways? Does she stop snorting shit?
I don't know if she stopped snorting, but definitely this leaves an impact on her. Like, just like we said, when Marcellus gets raped, like, he's going to be a different, worse, more sadistic Marcellus. He's going to be an unstoppable, you know, like, force of wrath and rage. Of course, this happens to a person. No matter who they are, it changes something in him. So it could be different things. Like, it could lead her to go to a certain group, you know, like, try on a new habit, change her lifestyle, because she has been risk-taking and very happy and powerful in her youth, in her health, in whatever. She hasn't had a brush with death. This was a brush with death. Too close a call. So, of course, if you're a human being and not like an AI or a robot, it changes something in you. Mm-hmm. How people deal with it, it differs. Like, how people cope with it, it differs. I wouldn't be so sure as she would stop snorting. She might go back, but it would take her different turns. You know, like, she might stop for a while and then go back when, you know, like, years go later. She might stop forever. But whatever happens, this is a definite point in her life. It will make her a different Mia. Like, the Mia we would have seen later would have been totally different from the careless, you know, like, sultry, you know, mysterious and devil-may-care Mia. No, this one is gone.
Is that why we think in the fight night she's so cold to Vincent? Obviously, they both, I know he's probably like, phew, but they both probably are kind of like, you know, but she's very, she's almost dismissive of him in a way. She's like, oh, you know, I never did thank you for dinner the other night. Like, it was just a very kind of like, oh, you know, like, oh, hey, thanks. I was like, hey, you know, thanks for picking up my dry cleaning or something. It was a very kind of cold response considering the trauma that they had both been through together. So do we think that's kind of maybe her start of her change, even though it's a very short, quick scene and we're really not paying attention too much to it, but it's intentional. She was told to act a certain way so that we would get the idea that, I mean, even if the, you know, the events that befall events due to this new section that we're in, the Gold Watch part, I think that was it. Like, that moment, like, when he blows the kiss, that moment was it. That ship sails that night. Even though there was a very kinetic energy between them, that horrific moment at Lance's house where she almost dies.
And it's such a turn off. Yeah. There's things that happen. You have sexual attraction for someone, or you have a flirtation going on, and then something shitty happens, and you don't want to see this person. I don't think she'd want to see his face again, ever. Same goes for him. Like, no, I don't want to remember the trauma. Because, and come on, let's analyze the situation. This is trauma for her. Probably for him too. But, you know, like, he's seen a lot of shit. Maybe worse than Mia, of course, in my mind. Mm-hmm. But Mia, this is trauma. So she's going to be dealing with trauma.
It's embarrassing for her.
And very kind of like exposes her vulnerability.
Yes.
Which she carefully tucked deep down.
Yes. It knocks her down a notch. And like, even in her mind, like, I'm here, you're just a lackey. Oh, I can't handle high. You had to save my life. You know, it's kind of that, like, almost like she doesn't want to see that person.
No, never. I mean, and understanding behaviors, you know, like, of going on and having an intense sexual attraction for someone, and then something big happens and you feel like this is a whole turn off. Like, okay. Yeah, bye. Thank you. It was nice. You know, like, this kind of thing, like, it's so formal. It's so formulative. So, yeah, definitely.
It's weird because I wonder if, again, we'll never know, because obviously the pacing of the scene requires us to move past that story. We're not in that story anymore, you know, but it's how these stories interweave. You know, we don't need to spend more time because we're now onto the Butch story. We're now onto Butch and Marcellus's relationship. We're about to get into that. So we don't need to worry about what we've already just seen. But I wonder if, while Vince is glad that he passed the test, I think he still had, because he saved her. Like, so he has a different feeling towards that, where he was able to save her, keep her alive, and return her home safely. Yeah. There's something there I think he still probably has for Mia, which we see in the blink, but he's never going to do anything. I think he still does. Yeah. Not in that moment. I think, obviously, the moment there's things going on, but I still think underneath, with the kiss that he blows her, he really did find something in her. He was afraid that she was going to die, and obviously for his own sake, but I think he also was afraid she was going to die because he actually had a little something there. He was intrigued to her. She's embarrassed as all hell and never wants to see him again because of that. Not because she doesn't think Vince is a good guy, but she had, her guard was let down without her consent, because it happened because she OD'd. I think she doesn't want to see him because now the mystique that she had built up is gone. And so now that she doesn't really have the power over him anymore. So she wants, I don't want to see this guy anymore. Because he reminds me of a moment in my life that I'm now shamed happened. A moment of weakness. Where he sees it differently. That's a moment in his life where he was actually rose to the occasion and succeeded. It's the only moment in the film even though most of it's his fault. He rose to the occasion and was able to keep her alive and stay loyal. And so, like, that's the only gold star he gets in the movie.
So deep down he's like, woo, Vince. Oh, yeah, I see your point. Yeah, maybe for him it's part of a good memory. He still has something for her, but it's not something he wants to act on, but maybe reminisce on.
Yeah, I think he probably hopes that she would see him and she'd be like almost a little warmer, like, not only just thank you for dinner, but like, Thank you for saving my fucking life. Like, really, it's like, yeah, fuck your cheeseburger and your final shake. I saved your life. I may have been also the cause of you almost dying, but I did save your life. And she just kind of coolly brushes him off kind of thing.
I totally understand her, by the way. Like, for me, this would be me. Like, I understand wouldn't even hate the person. Because when you're a woman who's, like, so used to just kind of, like, burying your vulnerability, it's so hard for you to admit to someone. Like, they always make it, which is why sometimes I hate movies. Like, thank you for saving. Sometimes it's so hard to say, you guys. Even for women, mm-hmm, whom you don't understand. Sometimes it's just like, you saved my life. Well, fuck off. I don't want to see your face.
I love
this. So I totally get it. Yeah.
That should be on some greeting cards. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You saved my life. Now fuck off already.
Yeah.
I like that. How do you say the things you need to say to people? Ah, yeah, you saved my life. Fuck off. We get it. Thanks. Move on. All right. Regardless, Mia has now lost interest, at least in the moment, and realizes that he's a reminder of a moment of weakness that she doesn't remember. And for him, it's the reverse. Yeah. It's a moment of him succeeding in strength that he was able to do what he thought he could do. So they both have different paths, and that's the last time they actually see each other.
Exactly.
And the next morning, he's killed by Butch, and that's what actually happens in succession of our stories. The next day, after this, that's the last time they say anything to each other, see each other. I wonder how that would affect me. I wonder.
She would definitely think of him even deeply now that he's dead.
Quietly, right? Like, she would probably mourn quietly in the shower, the bed, like, not in front of Marcellus.
Never, never. She will keep it like a secret, like a vault in her heart. But deep down, if he was alive, trust me, she'd like forget about him. She'd just dismiss him. How he died, that has this thing of glorifying people, but making them, you know, like, she will have the night, you know, like, overplayed in her head. But if he was alive, she would just, Vince, you know, and she would maybe pile up some disdain for him, some anger for him to overcompensate for the trauma.
Yep.
So yeah, now that he's dead, in her head, he'll be cooler, or she'll reminisce.
Yeah, she'll wish that things had gone differently because he's no longer attainable. Because even if he's out there, and she does build up a wall, and her and Marcellus fall apart years down the road, and maybe she starts to think about Vince again.
Yeah.
He's gone. When he's gone, he's gone. There's no... Even though, spoiler alert, even though at the end of the movie's there, he's really dead. Like, it's just out of sequence, folks.
So, Marcellus said you just got back from Amsterdam.
Sure did.
How long were you there?
Just over 3 years.
I love Amsterdam.
You been there?
I go there about once a year to chill out for a month.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Why would you? Hey, do you know a hash bar about 3 blocks from the Anne Frank house, the Cobra?
You been at a Cobra? I mean, that's a real small place. How'd you know about the Cobra?
I've known about the Cobra since Derek opened it.
You know Derek?
I've known Derek going on 6 years now.
Kidding. Derek and me are like buddies.
So are Derek and I.
It's blowing my fucking mind. I mean, I practically lived at the Cobra.
When I'm in Amsterdam, I literally live at the Cobra. I stay in the house with Derek and Petra.
You stay at the Cobra?
My picture's on the wall.
Which picture?
You know the photos Derek has behind the bar? Well, there's one of Derek between two girls wearing baseball jerseys. Petra's the one with a baseball cap, and the girl in the cowboy hat's me.
That's you in a cowboy hat? So you're the one in a cowboy hat. Jesus Christ. I mean, these things like this make me realize how small the world is. I could have took you out. How come Marcellus didn't hook us up?
Oh, when I go to Amsterdam, I go alone to be alone.
All right, well, let's find out what AI thought about our clinical diagnosis for Mia.
And now, the AI clinical diagnosis.
So once again, I turned to AI, and I asked it to perform a clinical diagnosis of Mia based on the psychological evaluation it had performed on her earlier. Now, before I reveal it, I should inform my listeners that this one went a little more in depth than my other ones have. There are actually 5 axes of diagnosis. Axis 1 deals with mental health and substance use disorders. Axis 2 deals with personality disorders. Axis 3 deals with general medical conditions. Axis 4 deals with psychosocial and environmental problems. And Axis 5 deals with global assessment of functioning, or GAF. Now, without further ado, here is Mia Wallace's clinical diagnosis. Axis 1, Substance use disorder, severe. Mia's engagement in substance use, particularly cocaine, appears to be a central issue. The overdose incident reflects a severe level of impairment and dependence on substances. Major depressive episode. Mia's emotional intensity and vulnerability, as portrayed in certain scenes, might suggest the presence of depressive symptoms. The quest for excitement and stimulation could be a coping mechanism for underlying depressive feelings. Axis 2. Borderline personality disorder, or BPD traits. Mia exhibits patterns of unstable relationships, impulsivity, and intense emotional experiences which align with some characteristics of BPD. Axis 3. Opioid intoxication and its consequences. The overdose incident signifies the immediate medical consequences of substance use, leading to a life-threatening situation. Axis 4. High environmental stress. Mia's association with a criminal underworld, including her marriage to a powerful gangster, exposure to high levels of environmental stress and potential trauma. And Axis 5, our global assessment of functioning GIF. A GIF score could be relatively low, reflecting significant impairment in Mia's overall functioning due to substance use, emotional struggles, and environmental stressors. In summary, Mia displays several behaviors and coping mechanisms consistent with borderline personality disorder. She exhibits signs of impulsivity and recklessness apparent in her decision to habitually use drugs. This points to poor judgment and self-destructive behaviors common in BPD. Her boredom and thrill-seeking also align with BPD criteria for chronic feelings of emptiness and frantic efforts to avoid abandonment. Mia may seek excitement and dangerous situations to fill an internal void. Her tumultuous relationship dynamics, including marrying an older gangster, also fit the BPD pattern of intense, unstable relationships. Individuals with BPD often idolize romantic partners initially, but feel disappointed later. Mia's lack of identity outside of her relationship suggests the unstable self-image seen in BPD. She may rely on external sources like wealth and marriage to provide a sense of self. That's pretty much, in a roundabout way, some of the things we discussed.
Definitely. Wow. I totally agree. There is a lot that we said there.
Folks, this is the early days of AI. 5 years from now, watch out. Terminator's coming alive. I'm scared. So it does, you know, it kind of points out a few of the things we talked about, possibly her filling voids. She goes after older men. Even what you said, that maybe she was going to just be enamored with Vince for a while and then toss him away.
Definitely.
This is more complex because I think, and this is strange, even though we get more information on Vincent and Jules that I've talked about up to this date, she's a more complex character than both of them.
Very.
We get to see them pretty much for who they are, and we get to see some of their arcs. But she is so mysterious, but yet her actions are speaking volumes that we as the audience have not seen. We know Jules is a bad motherfucker, and we also know that he also has a moment of clarity where he starts to see that he needs to change who he is. We see Vincent as the fuck-up who is probably always on a self-destructive path that he was always going to be on. But with Mia, she just is this enigma.
Very.
But yet, she thinks she's wrapped up so tightly, but yet there are clues. But we're so enamored with her, we miss them. You know, like we are missing, although I think we've picked a couple of them up because we've seen the movie enough times. But when you first see the movie, you don't go into the movie after you see this the one time and go, she's got daddy issues possibly. You know what I mean? You don't start checking these boxes. As you watch it more and more and you start to see the nuances and subtlety of her performance, exactly. You start to go, oh.
Oh, Mia.
Oh, Mia. Mamma Mia. But even Tarantino himself has said she's probably one of the more interesting, complex characters, even though she shares a very small amount of screen time.
And that's probably what makes her more impactful.
Yes.
Because we only see her fleeting moments and she sticks to our brains. Wow.
And she is on the poster. Just so everyone understands that, she's on the poster. Who's the only person on the poster? Mia Wallace on the poster.
Mia Wallace, baby.
Should tell you everything you need to know about even just the movie, what's happening. Everything kind of, except for Butch, but everything else kind of centers around it.
Okay, but I want to ask you, question.
Yes.
Don't you think that female characters are 99% of the time that complex? Male characters, it's different. You rarely get this character whom you feel like, oh my God, I gotta decipher this person. Most of the time, you have them, you know, like, okay, like, let's see Breaking Bad, for example. You have Jesse, and you have Hank. But you have Walter White, who is, for me, the Mia Wallace of the story. But usually you have Hank, and you have Jesse Pinkman. Okay, guys, I know you. I know you. Goodbye. You have Skyler and you have like her sister and you have this weird Lydia lady at the last season. And then you have the brotherhood. No, you rarely get that male character, which is so compelling that your brains are just racking. But with female characters, you can always get, because females have been kind of like continuously and habitually trying to layer themselves up, you know, like burying, burying, burying. You could get a boring housewife and she'd still have a lot of complex issues and stuff. And they just chosen gestures. But men like just what you said, like you have Jules and you have Vince and you have Butch and you have Marcellus, and they're mostly, you can understand them. You can understand at least a lot of the things about them, and they outlay it. Even the things that they hide, it's for a reason. But women sometimes hide things they are not even aware of, which makes them even more exciting to analyze. So this is what I feel.
I think women are better, especially in social situations, at playing like chess, using men as chess pieces, moving us around. Right. You know, like we only offer certain things men do. Women offer mystery. And since we're always chasing women, I think we're easier to be manipulated and moved across the chessboard as opposed to, you know, like I know in older films, we make women out to be dumb and they can't. I mean, God, how are they supposed to think and breathe without a man? Like if you watch enough 40s and 50s movies, it's all the women like, what am I supposed to do, John? You know, like they can't. Oh.
Exactly. Do.
Yeah. Oh my God, he's gonna be out of the house for 5 hours. What should I do?
Exactly.
And you're like, what?
And it never happens.
And there's the, what, you faint on couches? Like, I've never seen a woman faint on a couch in my life. Oh, like, well, who's fainting? What is happening?
Like, what is this? Oh,
he's gotta go to the store. You're kind of like, what the hell is happening?
It's just funny. I don't know. And I totally agree with you, which is why, in my opinion, the guys who are like deliberately keeping things are scary. They usually are the psychos and the stay away from him. She's like, he's different, you know. No. Stay away from him. Usually if a guy's like, I'm a gangster, yeah, I love you so much. But if he's like, I'm a good boy, I love my mother, and he's a gangster, you're like, okay, why are you playing this game, baby? Oh yeah, usually the guy who's like even boasting his shit is good. But the guy who's like hiding it behind, you know, like a very good exterior, kind of like Anthony Perkins kind of guy. Mm-hmm. You're like, thank you very much. No, not falling for this trap. So yeah, I totally get it.
I don't blame Mia for anything she does. She is a circumstance of her upbringing and surroundings, but also she is not a victim of her choices. And I love that about that. Every character in his world plays in that. Even with the one I've always said about the bride, he's designed a character who's actually, she's a terrible human being. If we talk about who the bride is in reality, she kills people. We feel bad because she was a pregnant mom. He does that great job of making us feel for her. If someone killed your family and they were pregnant, you wouldn't feel bad about them. You know what I mean? Like, it's a great way of getting us to follow these characters regardless of who they are or what they've done.
Even she knows she's bad. Like, she killed the mother in front of her daughter, and she's like, you're going to come for me. And this was something I really wanted to see. Like, please make this girl grow up to be an assassin and just, you know, have a face-off with the bride.
Smile! You're on Mia's camera.
Ready to go?
No, not yet. Do you ever see Barbara Walters interview the movie stars?
Once or twice.
Well, that's what this is. Pretend I'm Barbara Walters, and I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions.
About what?
Oh, life, the world, yourself, whatever I might find interesting.
I don't like answering questions.
Oh, but that's not your problem. That's my problem. I'm the interviewer. I have to make you feel comfortable so you'll open up and reveal things you normally wouldn't. Okay, I'll ask you an easy one first. What's your name?
Vincent Vega.
Any relation to Suzanne Vega?
Suzanne Vega's my cousin.
Suzanne Vega, the folk singer, is your cousin?
Suzanne Vega's my cousin. If she's become a folk singer, I sure as hell don't know nothing about it.
Well, now I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions I've come up with that more or less tell me what kind of person I'm having dinner with. My theory is that when it comes to important subjects, there's only two ways a person can answer. Which way they choose tells you who that person is. For instance, there's only two kinds of people in the world, Beatles people and Elvis people. Now, Beatles people can like Elvis, and Elvis people can like Beatles, but nobody likes them both equally. Somewhere, you have to make a choice, and that choice tells you who you are. Well, now, I'm obviously not going to ask you that one, because you're definitely an Elvis man. But you're hip to where I'm coming from. Can you dig it?
I can dig it.
I knew that you could. Okay, first question. Brady Bunch or the Partridge Family?
Partridge Family.
On Rich Man, Poor Man, who did you like more, Peter Strauss or Nick Nolte?
Nick Nolte. Of course.
What's your favorite way to say thanks in a foreign language?
Merci beaucoup.
In conversation, Do you listen or wait to talk?
I have to admit that I wait to talk. But I'm trying harder to listen.
If you were Archie, who would you fuck first, Betty or Veronica?
Betty.
Cut. Print. Let's go eat.
Let's find out, as was released years ago, but has resurfaced as we're getting close to the third, but the original cast listing that he had for people for each of these roles. Now, Mia's character had quite a few actresses lined up. Some sources say that the number one person he had lined up before Uma was Michelle Pfeiffer. Some of the other ladies on this list were Virginia Madsen, Marissa Tomei, Patricia Arquette, Elfrie Woodard, Jennifer Beals, the amazing Pam Grier, Phoebe Cates, Bridget Fonda, Nabusia Wright, I hope I said your name right, Jasmine Guy, Angela Bassett, Annette O'Toole, Deborah Winger, Robin Wright, Cynthia Williams, Meg Tilly. Now, those of you who've been listening, every person that he has written a character for, there is multiple people on here of different races, which is what I love. There's another world that might be around where this whole entire film has black actors. We actually had Denzel Washington was a thought for him. And again, probably wouldn't have signed up back then because Tarantino wasn't anybody at the time when this came out. He was on his list for Vincent Vega. We could have had Denzel Washington and Samuel L. Jackson on the screen together.
Oh,
I've said that the world would, it would just turn into a black hole and would be sucked in. The power of those two men would just pull the world, the earth would fold in on itself if they're on screen together. I don't think we could handle it.
Hello. No, no, no. Two, our mortal hearts can't handle it. So hard.
And imagine if like Angela Bassett played Mia in that version.
And a totally different interpretation. This is what I love.
Yes.
They would take a different angle to the characters. They could be like, wow. Oh my God.
When you look at the list, now you're glad that the people who took the role because you can't really see it anywhere else.
Never.
But there are versions of this as if like it was like a play. You could be like, oh, I want to see this cast version of this play to see what this interpretation of Pulp Fiction would be like.
Yeah.
Now, Uma's name doesn't appear on his original cast list. However, once Tarantino did set his gaze on Uma for the role, she originally declined. So Mr. Tarantino wouldn't take no for an answer, called her up and read her the script over the phone to convince her to take the part. Here's the cool thing about that. If she does not take this part, we do not get Kill Bill. Kill Bill does not happen as Tarantino and Uma, due to the Fox Force 5 discussion, came up with the character of the bride and eventually what would become, 9 years later, Kill Bill. So with Uma not on this film.
I love Kill Bill. I had a whole episode of podcast talking about it. Yeah, with my friends. And we were talking about the music, but I think it just seeped into talking about the movie itself.
It's easy to do.
Very. I love Kill Bill because you don't get to see all these women go off against each other in this ferocity and in this, you know, like intense violence. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for me, Kill Bill is just one of the masterpieces.
It's my second favorite movie of his, and it is one movie, in my opinion, even though it's broken into two parts.
Wait, which is the first one? What is your first?
This film, Pulp Fiction, has always been my favorite. It's the one that it changed everything for me about my direction in life, as far as where it comes to film and stuff. It was the movie that changed everything. Now, has he written better ones maybe here and there? But nothing that he's done has been as impactful in cinema as this film. So even if he thinks Once Upon a Time is his best film.
Really?
That's what he thinks, but it doesn't have, in my opinion, doesn't have the overall impact that Pulp Fiction does. None of them do. So, but anyways, we're not here to talk about all that. We did discuss this a little bit about Uma and the way she portrayed this character, like the outfit and hairstyle. It changed a lot of the fashion in the fashion world, even in the 90s. Her hair. It was so bizarre that she's wearing this black wig, and yet when I rewatched some of the interviews of her as she's on the press tour in 94 for the film, she had long blonde hair. She looks more like the bride than she does like Mia Wallace. It's striking.
I can't believe. Yeah.
And it is a wig. She said, you know, there's no way that you're going to cut the hair properly. You try to get it jet black when she had light blonde hair. It takes a long time to get it that way, you know, over the course of time, plus trying to cut the bangs. So, but I mean, what a great job for the hair and makeup department. One, to hide her hair, because I actually thought way back then that was her hair. Like, I thought she actually got the bob, she got the cut, and the whole thing. And Reality is, it's a wig, and her hair is hidden under there somewhere in maybe one of the greatest hiding shops ever.
I know. And at the same time, it's just, I think what makes it iconic is that she's not even that veteran of an actress. You know, like, she's very fresh-faced, which I think a lot of directors like. They like to take this, you know, like, kind of pure and virginal actor. He hasn't been in a lot of things, and they just shape them to be the character. Because if other more professional actors would have stepped in, you know, like, Angela or Michelle or, you know, like even Jennifer Beal or whatever, they wouldn't have done the same thing as her, because she was just nothing. She was a nobody too. She hadn't done a lot of things. And this is what brought in freshness to the role, which is why I think sometimes you don't always need the best performance ever. You don't need, you know, like the best actor ever. Sometimes you just need a newbie.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is what he saw in her. He saw in her a land that hasn't been planted before, and he could just take it and use it as his own. So more about a series for me.
Yeah, and she was spectacular. And then she gets to do the dance scene, which has become iconic. For as much as people like to say he stole this and that, yeah, there's references, but Travolta's the one who actually choreographed it. And there's young Uma Thurman up there dancing with a dance legend in film anyways, like the modern day Fred Astaire. Everybody who knows John Travolta knows him from his more dancing, singing days of his early 70s movies or late 70s movies. And here he is dancing, and there she is dancing. And it's just become one of those moments where, I mean, it's hard to say what's the most iconic scene, but one of the most iconic images you get on, you know, whether it's t-shirts or posters and that, it's the two of them doing the twist contest. And it's just a well-recognized moment. And she brought as much to it as he did. So for as you know, she gets a lot of credit and deserves a lot of credit for going toe-to-toe with a guy that everyone knew who John Travolta was and knew what his lineage had been in film and dancing. And they just worked together so seamlessly. And Uma Thurman, why do we think she hasn't got as much recognition outside of like her roles at Tarantino? Like, she's a spectacular actress. I know she's been in things. I don't want to pretend she hasn't. But I don't think she's been given the leading roles. That was she just not Hollywood darling? Like,
exactly. Of course she wasn't. And a lot of people would say things that now, for me, I understand is their way of kind of like labeling either actors or women in general. Like, she's not, you know, nice. She's not, you know, like, she's not friendly. You know, all these things. I feel like they focus on your social skills more than they focus on your acting skills or how you do a role. Besides, I feel like some actors need really good directors to invest in. Like, some actors are not that easy. You know, like, their actors are, like, easygoing. Any actor, any director can work with them. But no, some actors really, like, they take a specific sort of director to know their kind of, like, their fabric. You know what I mean? Like, to decipher them. For me, I think Uma is one of those actors. It's not easy for you to interpret her, to let her do your things, to know which strings to pull, which strings to just leave where they are. So for me, I think she's not that easy, not difficult to work with, but she's not that easy to handle or just, you know, utilize in your movie. So of course I would understand. She has a different physique, a different feature. She has different attitude, I think. She's more European in my mind, you know, like than your regular Julia Roberts, Meg Ryan-y kind of actress. You know what I mean? Like, maybe now we're open more to different actresses, but maybe in the past, I think they wanted a certain mold, a certain thing they can put you in. So yeah, I could see how that would have affected her. She has a different even face, a different way of handling her body. They wouldn't know how to handle it. You know, like, look at Tarantino, like, exposing her in a way that is artistic. I'm not saying exposing her, something bad. So the way you expose her feet, you know what I mean? Like, I heard this conversation with Kate Winslet talking about how some directors told her to hide her feet because they were too big. You know what I mean? Tarantino does not shy away from bodies. In a way, yeah, he is not that risque with bodies, doesn't show them too much. He's not that kind of director, but he's not shying away from certain things. You know what I mean? Like, your feet is big, I'm just going to show them, baby. So yeah, when I heard Kate Winslet, and she was kind of embarrassed, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, my feet are even bigger than the guys. So for me, it was like, oh my God, it's so hard for women. You know, like, it's like people just want something and it's always unattainable. So for me, an actress like Uma, of course it would be hard. Even her, like, everything about her screams she's different. She's going to take a lot of work, and they don't want the extra work. You know what I mean? Not Tarantino, though.
And, you know, for everyone who gets on for feet, we have had a more male frontal nudity, which is Bruce Willis, and I think maybe one more time. And we have not had a single female nudity in his films. Not at all. if feature biggest complaint. I mean, good Lord, you know, if that's your level of he's being expletive, then boy, don't watch some of these other films out there, folks. You're going to be shocked.
Oh, guests are no way. Don't touch him, baby.
Now, where does this film rank for Mia in her body of work, which we have just kind of discussed, which isn't as prevalent as it probably should be? I'm thinking number one might be for you is Kill Bill. Yeah, I feel like as good as she is in this, it's hard to put Mia, in my opinion, ahead of the bride. You know what I mean? It's hard to say that Mia is better than her role as the bride because she, you know, she's the whole reason for the film.
She's the whole deal, and she's the muse. You know, like for me, I love always analyzing like who's the director and who's the muse, who's the actor that killed the muse gap. Mm-hmm. So she was the muse full on in Kill Bill. So of course, no, Kill Bill should be number one, and this I think should be like probably number two. Probably if we find like two other or three performances. Maybe in something trashy, but she was doing a good job. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But I haven't seen a lot of Uma Thurman. I don't know. I'm not that Uma Thurman educated. I think there was, like, Truth About Cats and Dogs. I've seen her in the Batman one, which is okay. Yeah. And then I've seen her in, oh, my God, this movie.
She's been in a few, but she just hasn't been used properly.
The one with her husband.
Oh, Gattaca. Hope, no? Yeah, Gattaca, where she met Ethan. Yeah.
And there was this movie where she was really scary. She played, like, Kim Basinger's younger sister. Mm. And they were two murderous sisters. This is a very good movie. It's a 90s movie. And I remember watching it.
Dangerous Liaisons? Is that the one?
No. Dangerous Liaisons is the one on which Cruel Intentions is based.
Okay.
No. This one is even more. They had Richard Gere in
okay.
it. And they were both playing him. And it was very psychotic. They were two sociopaths, obviously. But you don't discover she's a sociopath until the end. It's a very good movie because they make use of her eyes. I think she has a very iconic stare. And I think this is why it's hard. They would always villainize her, always put her in, you know, like a femme fatale type, mm-hmm. but not Tarantino. When you see these scenes in the beginning of Kill Bill, and she's like mourning the loss of the baby, your heart breaks. Mm-hmm. So it's different. They always want a face that is clear like water, directors, where they can just put on their things. But her face is very pointy and, you know, like she has an iconic stare. So yeah, I think it would be definitely Kill Bill and then this and then anything else.
Let's ask our guest some fucking questions.
All right, we're going to finish up with your final four questions.
Number one.
What was your favorite line of dialogue spoken by Miss Mia Wallace?
All right, let me see. I've written them down. Okay. Roll me one of your six, cowboy. This is too much of a build-up when she's just bored. You know, like, ah. And then cooties I can handle. Okay? And then when you little scamps get together, you're worse than a sewing circle. I love this line so much.
She has such great lines in that diner scene. It is. I can't wait till we actually get a chance to talk about that scene. It's like an iconic scene. It's amazing.
Number two.
Now, what is your favorite moment or scene involving Miss Mia Wallace? And I know she's in a very small section, but some might say maybe the most iconic section of the film.
There it is, I think, for me. This and the Gimp one, of course.
Oh, yes. The Gimp is shocking. You can't get away from the Gimp. You're like, what the?
And the idea that you would see gangsters, like, with a ball gag, this is something revolutionary. Like, for me, this was a very iconic. These are the two most iconic sections, mm-hmm. definitely. Butch and, you know, Marcellus, and then this one. But, of course, I love their milkshake interaction. I love their casual conversation, their milkshake interaction. And I love, of course, the dance.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite. And at the end, when she tells the joke, the way everything, the tone just shifts and it just falls down. I mean, it's brilliant.
And it's a pretty good joke, especially because you hadn't heard it. It's a pretty good joke. Like, it's not a terrible joke. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Number three.
Now, where does this character rank for you in the pantheon of all Tarantino characters? And that's a loaded question. That's like picking your favorite pet or kid or parent. Like, it's a tough one to rank them. But where does Mia Wallace rank for you?
Like, if we had like a top, I'm not going to say top five, okay? But if we had a top 10, mm-hmm. definitely should be like among them. Because there are other, of course, even her or the bride, you know, like, or I Love His Villain, like Oren Ishii, or you have, of course, Jackie Brown. You have a lot of people. Even side characters I love. Like, there was this character played by Margaret Qualley in Once Upon mm-hmm. a Time. I liked her a lot. So, yeah, she definitely should be, like, in the top 10.
But she is the standard bearer. She's the one that broke through. She's the original Tarantino female character. So, even though there are others, and I would agree with you, that come after her, she broke the mold. She was the first to show. Yeah. Again, we're talking about her now. She's only on screen for a very short amount of time, really. She took the most of it.
And look at us. Talking about her for 2 hours.
Exactly.
Yes.
Number four.
And finally, this is the one that I added on our very first episode. Just pulled it out, said, we're going to use this. If you had to write her a dating bio, what would you say on her bio for her? What would gentlemen swiping left or right get to read about Mia Wallace?
For me, I like dating bios that are like just a line, a one-liner, and it's kind of bitchy. You know, like for me, I devised this like hoodies I can handle, but not yak about bullshit. This is what I would write.
Ladies, if there are you listening, please feel free to use cooties you can handle, but not yak about bullshit.
I mean, I actually think that when it comes to the movie, of all the characters, to me, the story I want to know the most about is Mia Wallace, as far as a viewer is concerned. I mean, I know everything, but if I was a viewer, that would be the story I'd want to know the most about. Like, you know, how in the hell did she even end up with Marcellus Wallace anyway? What is that about? And I've actually had women kind of describe that to me about how they like the fact that, like, her character, like, seems to be in control, but she's not in control. but she seems to be sort of kind of in control, and what's her situation with Wallace? And also, is it a happy situation? It doesn't suggest that it's a happy situation. And if she's brought back from death, is there going to be any changes?
And that's a wrap on this edition of Character Study. I would once again like to thank my special guest, Ms. Jalen Salas-Salman, producer of the JD's YouTube channel and writer for the In Session Films website, for joining me today. I had an absolute blast discussing the intricacies of what makes Mia Wallace tick. Now, you can find the link to all of Jalen Salas' endeavors and their socials in our show notes. And as always, you can become a member of the Church of Tarantino by following us on all our socials. Those links can be found in the show notes as well. Now, if you'd be so kind and take a moment to like, review, subscribe, and follow us, the Church would greatly appreciate it, as it will help other fellow Tarantino fans like yourself find the show. So be sure to join me again next week for our latest series, Inglourious Blueballs, as myself and my co-host, Sean Wheeler, take a look at Tarantino's announced James Bond movie, Casino Royale, that would have superseded Martin Campbell's 2006 version. So until then, I'm the Reverend Scott K. May Tarantino be with you always.
This has been a Man with an Exceptional Beard production.